Hey everybody, how's it going? This is Jonathan from the Product Breakfast Club. I guess you're listening to the Product Breakfast Club, so you know what it is. So there's no point in me even saying it, but at least I said it twice now. So there've been quite a few interview episodes over the last few weeks, and the reason for that is simple. I was traveling a lot. I was in New York. I was in San Francisco, and I had the chance to sit down with a lot of people that I wanted to speak to, or I was able to make those connections while I was there, and then I did the interviews remotely. But here is, I think, one of the last interview episodes, maybe for a while. I don't know, maybe for the rest of the year. For anybody who's just tuning into this podcast, it's actually usually myself and Jake Knapp being the author of Sprint and Make Time, and generally just very tall person. And it's usually the two of us just riffing and chatting about the product world, about innovation, about books, and just random kind of, you know, blabbing around and just chatting and talking about our lives and just essentially documenting what's happening on our journeys. But yeah, sometimes there are these interviews, and this is one of those weeks. And I think it's going to be a really interesting one, especially based on the feedback that I got after the Jules Erhardt interview. If you haven't heard the Jules Erhardt interview, it's a few episodes back. He's the guy who set up Us2 New York. If you don't know Us2, they're one of the most famous design companies, design agencies, digital product studios in the world. They also created this game called Monument Valley. Okay, that was a few weeks ago. Today, I have a special treat for you. Today, I'm going to be chatting with Mona Patel. Mona Patel is the CEO of two pretty successful companies. One is Motivate Design and the other is UX Hires. And essentially, Mona, just to kind of simplify it, she's an agency founder. So she runs two companies, she runs two agencies, and both are pretty successful. Both are multiple seven-figure beasts. And I really love sitting down with people who are just ahead of me in the game that I am trying to play. And I especially love sitting down with people who are just very open and honest about, oh, there's my phone. Let's keep that in the podcast. Let's just keep that lack of professionalism in the podcast. Let's even look at what it is. Oh, cool. Yeah, actually, interesting story. Two of the girls at AJ and Smart are in London, and they just spent the day with Gary Vaynerchuk, which is super cool. And they just sent me a picture of them and Gary Vaynerchuk. I'm super, super jealous. Anyway, whatever. I'm back. So Mona Patel. Yeah, exactly. We had a really great sit down in New York. Actually, it was kind of funny. A couple of episodes back, maybe even like five episodes ago, you'll remember that myself and Jake Knapp were recording the podcast in my bedroom. And that's fine when it's Jake and I, but Mona and I don't really know each other that well. We know each other a little bit, to be honest. I would say we're friends, but it is still weird for me to say, oh, hey, can you come to my hotel room to record this podcast? Could have been weird, could have been creepy sounding, but apparently I don't come across as very creepy, which is very good because there was not many quiet places to record. So you will still hear the New York beeping and kind of noises in the background, but I like that. So anyway, back to what this episode is about. Myself and Mona are going to be chatting about starting a design agency by accident. We're going to be talking about money. We're going to be talking about hiring. It's an extremely honest episode. We're going to be discussing the shitty parts of the design world and the agency world. And Mona has an incredible story about how she started her agency. So I have my story, you know, oh yeah, it was hard because blah, 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 blah. And she's like, yeah, okay, all of that, except I was also pregnant. So I was pretty blown away. Definitely made my story seem much less impressive. So that's really it. I hope you love this interview with Mona Patel from New York City. Let's go. Hey, Mona, how's it going?
Hi, I'm good. How are you?
That's the whole interview. Goodbye. I'm good. I am at the end of my week of New York work. And
I'm so happy that you're here.
Yeah,
bringing all your brilliance to my fellow UX people.
I don't know about that.
Or whatever you bring.
Yeah, I'm basically ready for a few drinks. That's the point I'm at right now, I got to say.
Yes, yeah. I'm down.
Let's go. Will we just go? Will we just bring the whole podcast thing with us? So I'd love to know, obviously, I've kind of given a little bit of brief overview of who you are. all that kind of stuff. But the good thing is I actually don't know anything about you.
Yeah,
so I can actually really like genuinely, curiously ask these questions.
Sounds good.
I would love to know, like, from when you knew you wanted to be a designer till the day you started your company. Can you just give me a bit of an overview?
It's actually really interesting. And I think a lot of my background in being Indian is going to come in. So I went to school in Boston at Tufts, and I initially thought I was going to be pre-med. I had no interest in design or research or anything along those lines. And I took a couple of classes, and it was very evident quickly that that was not the right path for me. I really loved the idea of serving people, helping people, you know, connecting people to solutions, but not with blood or anything that was disgusting. And so I found this amazing degree. It was called engineering psychology. I knew I was always interested in psychology, behavior, cognition, how the brain works. But I was a little nervous, to be honest, that my dad would not be cool with paying all the money that he paid for college with a psych degree. And so this engineering psychology was like a great combo. Engineering is what my dad would understand. Psychology is what he would really want to do. And so I took a class and immediately fell in love. It's product design, but in the context of understanding humans. So at that time, it was ergonomics. We learned around how airplane cockpits were designed, and our projects were medical devices and digital cameras, vacuum cleaners, dental floss machines. So it was a lot of design that took into account how a human is built. And then once I graduated, I started working in both space design and in product design. So worked at NASA, worked at Kodak as a consultant.
Wait a minute.
I know. Small little brands.
Let's just stop right there. How did you... There are going to be people listening to this whose entire dream in life would be to even step inside NASA's,
like, awesome.
Including me. So how did you even get in the door there?
So I started as an intern at a company that had a contract there in DC. Their office is in Greenbelt, Maryland. And so the project that they were doing is working on an interface that the Hubble Space Telescope control room scientists would use to monitor the telescope. And what they realized is that each scientist was looking at the screen, but not communicating with one another. And so as in pure like Mona/intern form, I was like, well, maybe we should take down the cubicle walls. And I kind of spoke it as an intern when I wasn't supposed to. And they liked that idea. Open office spaces were not a thing yet. This is like 1998 or so.
Okay, yeah.
They liked the idea. They liked my spunk. They liked that I just spoke up. And so I got to mock that out. Also, there were no like big screen TVs. It's like really dating me, but no like huge screen TVs. And so we talked about, could we put things up there that would encourage conversation and encourage communication? So what I do now and what I did then is probably the same thing, reframing the problem. They were thinking, let's design a screen that everybody would use. And because I was naive, I kind of just spoke up and talked more about, why don't we get them to communicate more?
Cool.
And then they don't need to rely on the screen. So for those that want to work at NASA or anywhere else, there's probably going to be a thread through all of this, which is speak your mind.
Right.
When what you say is smart, you actually get ahead. It's really not speaking that causes the problem.
I think it's not just speaking your mind, but a lot of people don't care that much, right?
Yeah.
A lot of people will speak their mind, but it's just like complaining about, oh, I'm tired or something.
Yeah, exactly. Or it's not my job.
Yeah, exactly.
It's not my role.
That's it.
Or I'm
it's
an intern.
My job.
Or, yeah, exactly.
Like, so maybe the thread through it is also that you are like proactive enough to want to even try something like that, to even want to speak out.
You know, again, because of my fascination with psychology and human behavior, it really is fascinating to me how much people let fear stop them from doing things, like speaking up, even just applying. I mean, a lot of people will say the same thing to me, like, oh my God, well, you worked at NASA and you have this degree, so that's why you get this.
Right.
I would never be able to work at blank. I would never be able to start my own company. And usually my question back is, have you tried?
Right. Yeah, yeah.
You know, like, maybe try.
Maybe try it instead.
And then try it three times. Yeah,
yeah.
If it doesn't work the first time. But yeah, you're right. Sitting here talking about it, you're not going to get there.
So you went from, you then worked at NASA for a while or?
So through the contract, government is very complicated, but through the contract, I worked at NASA through, I think it was about 4 months, 5 months.
Cool.
Yeah, it was really awesome. Really. And I didn't know how awesome it was, honestly, because I was like 20 something.
Okay.
Like, okay, anyway.
Didn't appreciate it.
Yeah. But then after, when I had it on my resume, it was clear that that was something that I'm glad I had. And then the web took off, you know, and a lot of the questions that we were working on, they were really fun. It was like Fast Company's first website. And they were like,
really?
Put on the website.
That's so
cool. I'm like, I don't know. How about fun stuff? I mean, no one knew. It was really fun to do design then because no one knew anything. So,
and at that point, were you freelancing or were you working for a company?
I was working for a company. So after I graduated college, one of my professors hired me. It's a company called American Institutes for Research. And I started in now what's known as design research. and loved it, you know, did session upon session and focus group rooms and really loved it. But what struck me about 2 years, 3 years in, and I'm really lucky I had great mentors that supported this, is that we were doing a lot of work on, can people use things? So usability testing is a lot about, can you find this button? Can you push this button? Do you know where you're going?
Yeah.
But that's not what sells. We did this awesome project with Mini, and it was being launched in the USA.
The car.
The design. So this is on a 56K modem. There's like this little flying thing that you have to catch, and then it opens up the navigation. So that is not usable, right? Like it failed all of the usability things, but everybody who came in wanted this car.
Right, okay.
And so my master's is in marketing because I
quickly
figured out that design is a vehicle for persuading people, for connecting, for emotional engagement. And at the time, usability didn't have that. Usability was much more about, can you click? Can you find? Can you do?
I think a lot of companies today still focus on that and ignore the sellability of a product, or ignore the market value of the product, or just ignore everything around it besides, does the user know how to do it?
Yes. And I think that's where, you know, even in some of your earlier podcasts, we talk about research and the value of research. If you're going to be that vanilla about it, yeah, you're not going to find much that product strategists and designers and creatives find interesting.
Yeah.
But if you can get into the heart of why you're doing what you're doing and get the stories around what people's lives are like and the impact that a product or a service could have on their life, you know, could they travel more? Could they have less debt? Could they have better relationships with their family as a result of the product that you're creating? That's really interesting for strategists. But 4 out of 14 people said is not.
Yeah, I have a weird relationship with research. I kind of like to be black and white. Like, I try to avoid being right in the middle of an opinion.
Okay.
So it's not that I think user research is total bullshit at all. I understand, and I've seen projects where it absolutely has made sense and completely changed the game for a product. But maybe I'm just going to ask
you. Why do you think that was?
I think it works when a product is already out there, has matured, and we're trying to find new opportunities for that same product. I mean, this is just something that I know I'm not 100% right about it, but I do believe that for a brand new product, most of the time, you can start with a hunch and then start understanding whether that hunch makes sense or not. But I did sit down with a guy last night who's working on a super complex actually, it's a cardiac arrest thing for
I did one of those.
Really? It's crazy. Stuff. This like was like a giant
defibrillator or...
Yeah, something like this for hospitals. And he was designing it for India. And he was like, honestly, I had my idea of what it would be. But once I went over there, then I realized, oh, they have these types of phones and this and this and this. I asked him like how much of his initial hunch lasted through it and survived the user research. And he was like, maybe 70%, but it was that last 30% that would have killed the entire project.
I love that. So I think for me, you know, validation research, I think we both agree that makes sense. We can tweak it, and whatever you've designed usually gets better if you talk to people and find out where the issues are. So that aside, on the discovery side, there's been a couple instances where I think it works. And this gets back to what we just talked about with the fear. There are many brands that have product / user experience teams that need more confidence.
Mm.
So even if they have a hunch, let's say, I'm going to break that down in number two, but even if they have a hunch, they're not going to do anything with it unless they have data.
To back
data.
Them up.
And the way their organization and culture runs is that they need that data to go up the chain. Now, I don't agree, by the way.
But that's just how it is.
That's just how they think it is.
Yeah, yeah.
I think if I was there, I would be able to sell this without doing research. But the way that they are and the way that the culture is, the way that culture attracts certain kinds of people to it, there's some old school banks, old school pharmaceutical companies where there's no way they would just go off a hunch.
You're so right. Like literally, not to just interrupt you, I'm the worst podcast host of all time, but this is exactly what happened today in a workshop. We got to the point where we were like, let's do this, right? Let's try this. Let's test this thing out. And one of the people in the room was like, we're not trying that because the data doesn't prove it. It took me like 1 hour to break it down that we were actually going to try this thing, but it was like, we're not going to do this because the data doesn't prove it. So I just kind of went over that person to the next person in the company, and they were like, yeah, I'm so glad you're even bringing that up. We've been wanting to do that forever.
See, to me, the data doesn't prove it. We can't try it is the problem.
Right.
And we'll talk about the kids' book. But to me, when you use the word can't in a way that is not literally you can't, it's just I don't feel like it.
Yeah, yeah. Or I'm worried about losing my job or something.
Egregious use of that word. Yeah, it drives me insane. The other thing I'll say is that I think where we would agree is that some of the most brilliant product design and strategy comes from insight, right? So hunch / insight. The question is whether research delivers an insight.
Mm.
I freaking hate when people say, oh, we're going to deliver insights. How do you do that? I mean, I would love someone to deliver me an insight. You don't know what I have in my
head. Here it is.
You don't know what I feel is insightful. You don't know what I already know, and therefore you can't give me what I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
An insight, by definition, is something that's new, that changes your perspective and hopefully changes your behavior. So if you see something and you don't need research because you see it and you want to move with that insight, go ahead. If you don't have an insight, if you have a product or service, like we just talked to a bank who wants to know what millennials want.
Right. This is still a comment. Yeah. So what do you do in those scenarios?
They don't have an insight.
What do you do?
For me, because I have the human factors background, I never really try to ask people what they want.
Right.
I love to observe.
Yeah.
And so our method is either an observation or insider insight, where we're having two friends have a conversation. They don't even know who sponsored a quote study or what they're asked to talk about. They talk about their lives. They talk about where they're in debt. They talk about where they lie. They talk about their relationship with money and what their parents taught them. They talk about their goals in the future. And then we use that. We use that. Motivate uses that to come up with where there are stories that prime a team in a workshop for insight.
So you said two friends speak to each other about these things.
Yeah.
But how's that set up? Are they put in a room? Are you just following people around?
No, we don't follow them. So we have a group of people that are onboarded. They're coaches, salespeople, some UX, though, and many times UX people don't do a great job, to be really honest.
Interesting.
And then so we give them like a mission.
Right.
And then they go out and use their personal network. And so we've been able to get doctors and people who are low income and people who have not gone to college, people who have gotten a PhD. You know, you can get a lot of segments through this method because people know people.
So basically, you give someone the task to say, look, this bank, or you don't even tell them about the bank, or how?
I may not. Yeah, in this case, it would be this mission is about understanding the relationship with money.
Right.
So take a friend who has the most money, and it could be real or it could be your imagined, and have a conversation with them about how they've accumulated wealth.
Do they record the conversation?
They do. They get paid more.
And does the friend know that they're being recorded?
Yes, always.
Okay,
always.
Okay. So it's almost like a more open and honest.
It's like this.
Yeah, it's a little bit like this.
Yeah.
Okay, that's really
it's
interesting.
It's kind of like this, where you're kind of interviewing, but you're not. We're having a conversation. We're asking people to just converse and bring in their perspective. Like user research, you brought in your perspective. In a user research interview, like a moderator doesn't bring in their perspective and say, you know, I actually agree, disagree. They would just continue interviewing. The conversation, the back and forth, the probing, the provoking, the, I don't really think that that's true of your mom. That kind of stuff.
Okay. So let's say I was part of Motivate.
Yeah.
And you were like, okay, Jonathan, I need you to go hunt down some person that you know who does this, this, and this.
Yeah.
I would go talk to them, but I would also give my opinion. It would be a conversation. It would be like maybe even over a drink, and the difference is like it's a bit more real, I guess.
Yeah.
And maybe if you don't tell them exactly what you're looking for, but you're still paying them.
Yep. We pay everybody, you and the person. So it's like $100 each.
Does someone in your company listen to that entire thing? And like, what are like the things that get spat out of it?
Then it turns into more of like a qualitative research project, right?
So
you get the transcript.
Yeah.
And we have two readers go through each transcript. They pull out the themes get presented to an editor. The editor picks the themes and puts them together into the stories. And then the writers write the stories. So it's a pretty lengthy process, but it's all 2 weeks. Because we've got it down. Yeah, we've got it down.
I'm just eating here.
You're eating. No, the reason I like it is because of that ad hoc, off-the-cuff conversation. And it helps me hear things that I wouldn't have thought to ask, which to me is the beginning of how I can get an insight.
So actually, I'm just trying to understand the system.
Yeah, the process. Okay, so
I'm the client, and I come to you and I say, I need to innovate. Millennials, help me.
Yes, perfect.
What do you do?
So then we have a group of, I think it's about 2,000 insiders.
Okay. You know? How did you get them?
So these are all handpicked.
Wow.
We were really picky about it.
So that's a pretty good asset that your company has, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And these people are really interested in having the best fucking conversation ever. That's the way we say it. And so when they come back with the conversation, we point out where they led someone or where they introduced their opinion, where they didn't maybe ask more detail, because their intrinsic goal is to get to know people better. What we're doing is paying them to have conversations, which they think is amazing. And then also giving them feedback about like, did you think about asking them this? Or did you think about maybe validating when they said that? And so hopefully we'll turn into almost a training curriculum of people who listen. So we could use those in the world.
What do I get back as the client?
You get back a set of stories that are maybe personas on steroids.
Okay.
Way to think of it, you know? So it's a minute in the life of someone as they talk about what their parents taught them when it came to money and how they internalize that. And what decisions they're now making, what mistakes they're making, what mistakes they know they're making, and no one's helping them. See, strategists love this because we did not say 4 out of 14 said this, you should do that, consider doing this. It's just the story with an implication and an opportunity. And mm-hmm. the way we do that is basically say, look, here's a brand that had a similar problem, and then they took care of it. And so it's all about priming for the insight. I can't deliver the insight.
That's
all I can do is
though.
Set you up to have one.
That's actually really interesting.
It's awesome.
I'm not like the most pro research thing, but that sounds like it would be a good thing to actually have for us at the start of a sprint.
I think so.
To show the client as a primer or something.
I have to tell you, the people who don't do well with this are researchers.
Right. If they don't like it, that's good for me.
To me, this is research the way I've been taught, you know, which is, do you have a better understanding of a user need? That's why I do research. But for a more traditional researcher, I've had many conversations now about, well, what's the sample size? And how do you know that they didn't introduce a bias? And it's like, I actually think they did introduce a bias, which
right.
I'm happy
it's
about.
It's real life.
It's real life.
That happens.
Yeah. And this sounds a bit obnoxious, but you know, when we do research, it's like, it's really not that surprising. I can pretty much guess after 3 or 4 sessions what people are going to have a problem with. This has blown my mind every single time. Like, there's an example. We worked with Ad Council to do a project that I can talk about. So they had already done focus groups to understand why don't people get screened for Alzheimer's. And what they found is people didn't know that there was a screening and what it entailed. Do I go to my doctor? Does insurance cover it? How long does it take? Does it hurt? If you tell them what these things are, then they'll go do it. That's what the focus group said.
The focus group that
focus
you
group.
Did not.
I didn't do it.
You had
I
nothing
did not
to do
it.
With that. Okay, so that data came out of the focus group.
That data
group.
Came
okay.
out. I met with the client, the head of strategy, and he said, so we're kind of already done with this project, but this would have been a really good one. Of course, being a good BD person, I was like, wait.
Wait a minute.
Wait a minute.
There's money here.
Let me just do a quick insider insight project. So we had, I think, 4 people talk to 3 people, and it was just people who had Alzheimer's running in their family of any age. And would you get screened? And the stories were fascinating. Of course, no one knew there was a screening. So we validated what they found in focus groups. Of course, these were the questions that they had. But then in almost half the recordings, there would be this pause. And then like the grandmother would open up to the grandson and start revealing that they don't actually want to get screened.
I was wondering that my grandmother had Alzheimer's and seeing how that played out, I wouldn't want to know.
That's it. Because when you get diagnosed, that is the
right
death
now,
sentence.
Yeah, there's no, you can't really do anything about it anyway. So what's the point in screening it?
Apparently you can.
Really?
Yeah. You can't combat it, but you can reduce the symptoms.
Okay.
You can extend the quality of life. But most people have this experience. And so why die twice was the storyline.
Interesting.
And so when you deliver that, that changes the entire campaign strategy, right? The other thing that was fascinating is that with cancer, for example, you have it, you feel it, you know that it's impacting you. With Alzheimer's, you don't know that it's impacting you. And so another reason why they don't want to get screened is now they're going to feel all this guilt about what they're going to do to their family, and they won't even know that it's happening. And that dissonance is not something that people want to live with. And this is all happening in your mind, but you don't say it in a focus group.
Of course not.
Of course not.
It's kind of shameful.
But you'll tell your grandson. And on top of this, like a little side note, why I love doing this is that in about a third of the cases, people come back and say, I've never been asked these questions. I was so touched that my grandson sat down with me for an hour and asked me these questions. And so just the good karma and energy that we're doing with this makes me super
happy. That's cool.
That people are actually feeling like, I can't believe I didn't know what my grandmother thought about this. Or I can't believe that I've never talked to Jake about how he spends money and saves money and what he thinks about money. We're trying to pick these topics that are that important. And that's one of the criteria for whether we do an insider insight project with clients. If they want to know, like, what do people think of my Instagram? Our insiders don't want to talk about that.
Yeah, yeah.
It has to be a human need that they get to unpack.
Yeah.
And so now we get to do that work. But the Alzheimer's one was one of our early projects, and it really kind of struck a chord with me at how powerful a conversation between two people who know each other can be as a form of, quote, research.
That's interesting. I haven't really heard about doing that, like, as a research tool, because
I made it up.
That's good.
But a lot you would have heard of it.
A lot of companies would think that it's too risky or too full of bias or too messy.
Our project is like 10 conversations, 2 weeks. Like, we do a trial every time with a client because of that. You know, even if they listen to this and are ready to do the whole year, whatever, like everybody has to do a trial.
So the 2 weeks basically can get you
all the way to story.
All the way to the story, which is
kickoff. First conversation with me, all the way to the story.
Is the delivery like a PDF? Like, what is the delivery?
Yeah, so it's almost
I'm so nerdy about deliveries, by the way.
I want to
know.
It's almost like a podcast with a visual. So we ask our clients to join a bridge. There's a visual that's coming up, which has all the, it's just imagery.
A bridge?
A conference call line.
Okay, a conference call. Okay.
And then there's imagery only that's coming up on their screen. And then two of our members read the summary and then read the story. And okay. So it kind of feels like a moment where you're listening to the story and watching the visuals. And we did that because, you know, I want the stories to be powerful and engaging, but more importantly, some of the best stories can't be untold. And that's what I'm aiming for.
Can't be untold.
Untold. Yeah.
Because, what do you mean by that?
Well, research reports, I forget.
Ah, okay. That's true. Yeah, they're fucking boring.
This, you'll remember the story of Alzheimer's. You remember why die twice.
Mm-hmm.
And so we really try to kind of turn down the lights and be a little bit more theatrical with our presentation so that it lands.
That definitely wouldn't work for us because our results are always so aggressively, like literally put this over here and you're done. But we should do it with the darkness. Like, put the button over here.
Put the button over here.
So I got like highly, highly derailed on my journey to asking you how you started.
Right.
Like how did you
start Motivate?
How did you start Motivate?
So I worked at one company for 4 years. I worked at another company for 7 years, grew up to be running the East Coast for that company, learned a ton, and then just wanted to do it on my own. I started having ideas about how I wanted to run the operations and where I could trim money, add money, do something different. And of course, when you're an employee, you have a certain limit there. And so I branched out and started the company. It was just me. I was a one-person company. And then I was pregnant 2 months later.
Oh, wow.
I know.
That's amazing. Before we go into that, because I'm sure a lot of people, and also myself and my wife are just about to have a kid as well.
Yep.
Which obviously, I guess for the guy, it's not as intense to run the company, right? But so that will be really interesting.
The hormones are a fun little addition to the whole situation.
So wait a second. Going back to the starting of a company, for me, it was super chaotic. It was random. I didn't really expect it. Was there like a trigger?
Yeah, there were, it's 2009 when this happened. So the economy sucked.
Yeah, economy shat itself.
The economy shat itself. And so every idea about how you were going to make a dollar was important. And I felt like I had some good ones that would make UX recession friendly. You know, how I could bring the price down, how I could offer more value, how I could build teams, which is where UX Hires started.
Did the company start with the hires part or was it
Motivate
UX
started
design?
In 2009 and then I started UX Hires in 2010. But Motivate functioned a lot. Like, you know, squads. We'll put 4 people on site, they'll get it done, and then they'll come back. And that worked. In a recession, that works, right? So they've laid off 50 people, and they still need to get stuff done. So we would place 4 people for 6 months. And then UX Hires turned into the arm that places full-time, and then Motivate still runs like a squad.
Right. There's 3 businesses, from what I can understand.
Yeah,
okay,
there's
a design agency.
Well, Motivate, like, we do design work.
Right.
But we just kind of do it as squads.
What do you mean as squads? Like, so, you just send the team in.
Yeah, we send
the team. What's the difference between that and the UX Hires then?
UX Hires, they hire full-time talent.
Okay.
We have 2 clients who want to hire 6-person teams.
Right. So the Motivate is kind of like this, what's it called? Hot seating? Something
kind
like
of,
that?
Yeah. I mean, we do projects as well. But yeah, it's like a client has a concrete need and we'll serve it through Motivate Design, or they need people, which is UX Hires, or they need really cool research, which is Insider Insight.
Okay. So 3 businesses.
3 businesses.
Is it under one company?
We're going to put it under Motivate and then rebrand the current Motivate Design later this year.
Okay.
Yeah.
Why?
Because you get one MSA with clients and it's a lot easier to serve them with any one of the businesses.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. But that's why. It doesn't really matter.
So you started, though, with the hot seating, the squad business, whatever it's called. It was just you on your own first, and how did you get, like, the very first client?
Well, then I'm pregnant.
Yeah, that's insane.
The very first client came, I changed my LinkedIn profile to freelance UX strategist. And then people who knew me were like, whoa, wait, how much are you charging? I'm like, well, what's your budget? and so that was the beginning. LinkedIn was huge for me. First 3 or 4 projects came in through that. Yeah. And then I think I even tried to pitch once or twice, but that was a disaster because I was open for like 4 days, 5 days, you know, that's not going to work. But it was really just word of mouth and really being flexible about how I would approach it. So it was, what's your budget? What do you need done? Sure, I'll do it.
And LinkedIn changing to UX strategist was where like the people just started messaging you.
Yeah. Huge.
Wait, so you created Motivate.
Yes.
You said you're the owner of this agency now.
Yeah.
You're still the CEO and founder.
Yeah.
But at that time, you just said, I have an agency now, but it was just you.
It's just
which
me.
Is the classic great way of starting.
Well, I tried to buy monapatel.com, but some idiot was like, it's $10,000.
That's funny. Oh, I just bought a domain today,
and
by
I was
the
like,
way.
Are you kidding?
Oh,
and it was
10,000.
Oh, I couldn't buy monapatel.com. That's how limited my thinking was.
Yeah. Back then, I didn't think AJ and Smart would survive more than like 2 weeks.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
I didn't care.
What am I doing?
What were they asking for? How did it develop into more people?
First client was BlackRock, and they had a really awesome design team that had done some work, but were feeling stuck about a few of their design decisions. They couldn't come to consensus. So they asked me to come in for a day and help them come to consensus, like pick one or the other. And there were a bunch of really strong, awesome designers on that team. And they just didn't know which way to go. And they didn't have time to do user research and they just needed to launch. And so that was one of the projects. Citi was another, where the global transaction services arm, so it's like treasurers and how they manage money, they needed to make that iPad friendly.
And it was just you at this point, still just you.
Me, yeah.
Okay.
But right around then, I found out I was pregnant. I was like, okay.
Well, okay, get into that.
We got to figure that out. Again, no plan, right? This was all really flying by the seat of my pants. And the pregnancy, I didn't even take seriously until I was around 7 months pregnant.
Okay.
I was like, I got this. It'll be fine.
Yeah, it's
like,
not I'll real.
Go, throw up, come back, do a project, go, throw up, come back. I just kind of kept going. But the benefit that both pregnancies brought me was that I had to step away from the business.
Right. Early on as well. That's like a really fast way to learn how to automate something.
That's it. And hire well and create process documents and follow process documents. And so both times when I came back, I had a different job. I was a UX strategist. I had a baby. And then I was not because I hired better UX people than I was. So then I was actually a CEO, like running an operation of, I think it was 7 or 8 people at that time. And then had the second baby and the operation was running by itself.
That's really
amazing.
So
then I wrote a book and did this and did that, right? Because I took myself out of the job.
Really fast.
Of those, right. And I only could take 3 weeks. This is something that's interesting about the US.
Yeah, that's so crazy. You get it like minimum a year.
Europe. I don't know. How would you do that?
I don't know.
Yeah.
I have no idea.
I mean, there's like a practicality to this.
Yeah.
Like you're the founder
yeah.
and the whole company is based on your reputation.
Right.
You cannot take a year, which sucks.
Did you come back full time after 3 weeks?
No. Both times I came back slowly.
Yeah.
And I worked part time. And now I still, again, it changed everything because now I still try to work part-time. So that gives me time to volunteer and teach and do all these other things that I do.
So you started the company. Mm-hmm. 2 weeks later, 3 weeks later, you're pregnant.
2 months later.
Two months later, you're pregnant. When did you hire your first employee?
So it was December. So 4 months in.
Four months after that.
Yep.
Okay. And the reason you had money to hire an employee was because of the kind of one-on-one work.
The work was growing. So Citi actually was the first set that I hired. BlackRock as well. So we did that project. I went on site. I was like, pick this. That design went well. And they said, you know what? Let's revamp the whole thing. So we need to go to trading floors and do ethnography. Now I'm like a bumbling little like basketball and I did not carry that well either. So I was like big. That was a lot of work for me to go to London and then come to. So I started hiring for that.
Okay.
And then there was another company where it was a travel agency and we had to go to like 5 different cities. And again, I was just like, I can't do that. I'm like 7 months pregnant.
So you brought in other people.
I brought in other people. Right. And I did not always do that well. I've now learned how to hire.
Okay.
But damn, I was bad.
How long did that take you? Because this is like something that I definitely did not do well for quite a while.
Yeah. What I did wrong is hire based on my gut and how much I like people and subconsciously where they fill the gap in me.
Mm.
Now there's a fucking serious process.
It's Tell me, please, how you do it.
I have an official interview guide that I can send you. It is
Are you
legit.
Serious?
It is 6 pages long. Everything from tell me about your favorite course that you took and why did you like that? Any course?
Can I please have this?
What are you most proud of? What's a goal that you have in the next 12 months? How do you plan to achieve it? Are you a morning person or evening person? Where's your discipline? I mean, really, like it's like fucking legit.
That's cool.
Yeah. At this point, I've learned we need to ask, hire slower and fire faster.
Yeah. Yeah.
But that's probably been my hardest lesson as a founder.
Yeah.
Because I'm a people person and a bit of a people pleaser too. So I just, you know, I'm always
Me
trying
too.
To help people feel better and, you know, mentor them and, you know, maybe you could do this and die.
That's crazy. So you had the kid, you slowly went back. You had already created some systems to get the agency to run.
Yeah, I had to. Some of them were stupid. Some of them were put everything into a folder called Mona's maternity leave and I would check it every day.
That's amazing.
So everybody had to like put their deliverables or their proposals or whatever they worked on. And I was micromanaging like while I was breastfeeding.
That's
was
so
like
funny. That's so funny.
But, you know, when you don't know, I mean, I don't have an MBA.
This was in New York, right?
Yeah.
You were in New York. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So you kind of had that first year. How long did it take you guys in terms of AJ and Smart? It sounds like you got there a lot faster than us, but it took us around 4 years before I was like, this is actually going to work. And in those first 4 years, there was a lot of cash flow issues. There was a lot of like messiness. There was a lot of uncertainty about how to make money. And actually, it took us 4 years to hit our first million. For me, that was kind of a turning point where I was like, okay, actually, now I know how to make money at scale.
So I went to Tony Robbins 2.5 years in and I made
to his
like Unleash the Power.
Okay.
I made my first million that following year.
Really? Because of that?
I think so.
Can you please like dig into that a
tiny bit? It gets back to what we just talked about with the fear. A, I didn't think I could do it.
Yeah.
It wasn't like in my universe of a possibility. And then B, if I put it in my universe, I didn't believe I could do it. And so I do attribute a lot of the boldness that I started to have after the Tony Robbins
thing. That's crazy.
Isn't that crazy?
That's so amazing.
It doesn't matter what
hear.
You do, but like it really untapped, unleashed whatever. Yeah, I forgot the name.
It unleashed the power within you.
Yeah, it did. It totally did.
That's crazy.
It was awesome. And so the first million came within months after that. It didn't even take a year.
Wait, how long was that into the company then?
Two and a half. So I came back after Jaden, my older son, and then I went. Because I know Jaden was like 6 months, 7 months. I was nervous about leaving him at home.
Yeah, sure.
And so he must have been a year and a half. So I'm about 2.5 years into the company.
And you already hit your first million.
Yeah. And then it just went.
Once you hit the first million, yeah, then it actually like, becomes a bit more obvious. Yeah. How many people were at the company when you made your first million?
Like seven or eight.
Seven or eight. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay,
and then it went up to about 40 something.
Yeah.
And then I brought it back down. Partially, I brought it down. Partially, it came down.
Right.
Because I wanted to do insider insight. And it's a different type of person that I need for this business than traditional research. So we've actually only done like 4 or 5 traditional research projects this year, but we've done a shitload of insider insight.
It also sounds easier to sell because research, especially for companies, they're just burned out on that shit.
And they have internal resources. And like I said, it's more about the confidence, which we could probably give them in a day of workshopping.
Yeah.
I don't think people have the budgets. I mean, we were at the peak. I remember there was an ethnography project. It was like a couple cities and it was almost $200,000.
Right.
Who has that?
Yeah. Do you mind me asking me, like, what do you guys charge for 2 weeks?
For the insider insight?
Yeah.
$20,000.
Yeah, that's really good.
Yeah.
Yeah, you probably should charge
it's actually
a little
under. No, because I want them to try it.
Because it's a Trojan horse product.
It's like a loss leader, but it's also just like, I want you to try it. I want you to see it. I want you to feel the stories. And then, because it's not for everybody.
Right.
You know, if we go back to that millennial banking client, they don't know what to do with this. You and I could look at these stories and come up with 14 product ideas. They still don't know what to do.
What are you going to do with that? I mean, that's obviously an opportunity.
That's why I'm calling you.
Okay, yeah, we just get in there and just bang those out. That's really cool. I actually think I have a much clearer understanding about this insider insights
thing. Yeah, it's
a nice
really
product.
Awesome.
It's nice.
It's a nice product. It has tremendous value. I think it's some of the best work I've done in my career. You know, like the kinds of stories that are coming out, like the Why Die Twice, are very hard to get to in moderated research. And the fact that we're getting them every single time. Like we did another one with a client who wanted to study what a brand membership means. And so we stepped back and said, well, let's talk about relationships.
I should have talked to you today because this is exactly what I was working on.
So it was what makes a good relationship and what makes a bad relationship. And then you can just replace relationship with membership. And so we did the study and we found, you know, things that people said about brands. But then the best ones I thought were my relationship with my ex-wife, my relationship with New York City, where I know the ugly. I'm aware of it. I've signed up for it, but I want it as a part of my relationship because it's real, it's authentic, it helps me know my place. And so things like that, where now you apply it over to membership, like there are some things that are annoying about working with brands. Brands try to hide it a lot, but some of the stuff that we're already starting to see is how to be more authentic in your interactions so that people appreciate that and feel like you're contributing to a relationship with them versus duping them.
That's really, really interesting.
It's very heady stuff with insider insight, which is why creatives and strategists love it. And someone who's looking for like, but what did four people tell me to do?
Don't. So the bottleneck in that business, it sounds like, are the people who have to take that data and listen to the stuff and turn that into the insights, right?
The client has to have the insight. So what we can do is turn it into stories.
You can turn it into stories, but and that then, sounds like not, I mean, is that easy?
There's a whole 45-page process document on it. So
but how many people do you have doing that?
18.
You have 18 people doing that. That's amazing. I'm assuming they're not all in the office. They're all remote, right?
No, most come into the office.
Okay.
But they don't have to. And we've already tried to scale a little bit, like had one person swap in for another just to make sure. There are some process documents. There's a lot of rules around how to do it. But that's, again, knowing what I know now about how to run a business, I know don't do it off the cuff. You know, create the process, write it all down, train people on the process, have them execute on the process. I'm a completely different CEO on Insider Insight than I was on Motivate Design. Motivate Design was like, I like this project. Let's do
it.
This is like, fuck this. Like we're going sounds, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. That's the order every time, 2 weeks, turn it out.
It sounds like you're about 3 years ahead of me. About the documentation, right?
Mm-hmm.
Do you do that?
No.
Who
I
does
hired
it?
Somebody to do that. So I have a program manager who manages.
That's a job. Okay. I don't even know what that means.
Yeah. It's a
job. Can you tell me what that means?
So her job is to make sure that when a client signs, actually she's there before. all leads to happy client. She makes sure it goes through the process the way it's supposed to go through. If there's any hiccup, she fixes it and then she documents how she fixed it.
That's not like an MD? That's something different.
No, she's right out of school and a powerhouse. Her name is Mary. Hi, Mary.
Hi, Mary.
Hi, Mary. She is a powerhouse.
How do I find someone like that?
You know, initially, Mary came to us for a junior BD role. And she's business too...
Biz dev.
She came to us for a junior biz dev role, and she could sell anything to anyone. But she has more than that. She actually is very thoughtful and creative about how she solves problems. So we tried this role for her, and she just excelled. And so I think in retrospect, now looking at that, it's a balance of creativity and operations that you need in a person. And a person who's not... Again, back to fear and excuses, right? A person who's not like, well, I don't know. We've never done that before. We haven't done any of this before. And she knew that. And that's where she thrives. She loves like that fact that we haven't done this before.
Yeah.
And she anchors whatever she can. And then everything else is allowed to be organic. And it's very rare to find people like that. But I have to be honest, this, you know, younger crew can do it easier than someone who's been doing research for 20 years.
That's the cool thing as well. I think like some of the best people in AJ and Smart who are like right now in San Francisco, we have three people who are running these workshops today, running a workshop for Google.
Nice.
And one of them is a comedian.
That's awesome.
She's like an amazing facilitator. One of them is our head of sales. She's also an amazing facilitator. And one of them is our head of training, but she's like now being put into like running the whole training team.
Yeah.
I really feel like sometimes people who just don't really 100% know how this stuff works do a much better job because they don't see the legacy.
One of my favorite hires, and I tell this story in the book as well, Sean. Hi, Sean.
What's the name of the book so I don't forget
Reframe.
In the intro?
Reframe.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Sean has an engineering background, wanted to do sales, had no background in sales. So I was like, I'm sorry, I can't hire you. But he was so charismatic. I couldn't stop thinking about him.
Yeah.
So I asked him to come in for a week. And I was like, let's just see if we can find a place for you because he was that special. He is that special. And he came in, he didn't know anything about UX, so he spent the day on YouTube watching everything he could watch. And then by the end, he's like, quiz me. I loved his tenacity. I loved his hustle. I loved that he was willing to be vulnerable and put himself out there saying, quiz me. Not like,
so
hey, I know.
Rare.
I was like, we're going to figure out a place to put you. And he and I partnered together for many years. He's now at one of our clients, Jet. But he is a rock star.
So cool.
Yeah. And we still have coffee and I adore him. And I can't wait for him to start his own company.
Can I ask you a question? What was the, and you don't really have to answer this honestly, but you can if you want to. Have you had difficult moments running the company where I'm thinking like the deepest, baddest, shittest moments because people hear too much about the good stuff
running these companies. Happy to. So I'll just go right off of the last thing. I think it was 2 years ago, or maybe longer, 3 years ago when Sean quit. That shook me to the core, you know, so I definitely see him as a protege and I'd spent so much time working with him. And we made the role for him, but it wasn't really a revenue generating role.
Okay.
So we had a cap on what we could afford and he needed to make more, which I completely understand and of course respect. So when he left, that was really tough for me because it was him and one or two others that left that I had emotional connections with. Like I had gotten them out of school and seen them shine.
Yeah.
I questioned me, you know, I was like,
did
what
feel
did
like
I do?
Betrayed or something or?
No. Nothing
okay,
negative
not that.
Like
you
that.
Just thought.
Just disappointed in myself.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Like that I couldn't keep them happy here.
Yeah.
Like I'm the mother of Motivate. I always think of it that
right.
way. And so they weren't happy in my house, you know? And so I took it really personally. That was a tough time. I think it was last year. There was one dip. We really are very good about cash. We are conservative and really try to be careful. But there was one moment last year where there was a challenge of how we were going to get money, like how we're going to make payroll. That sucked.
How bad was it?
I was crazy in debt.
Yeah.
Crazy in debt. Like six figures and not
six
low.
Six figures in debt.
Yeah. By the time we were done. And that didn't feel good.
How many months did it take you to get out of debt?
I'm still getting out of debt.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I'm almost done.
I mean, debt is not a bad thing, but debt, the first time you're a founder.
Oh my God.
Thing.
Yeah.
You know, debt is a good thing. It shows that you're investing in your business, but debt, when you first have to take it, sucks.
Yeah. Well, I mean, just so you know, AJ and Smart has been through like three moments in the last maybe 2 years where we almost went really, really deeply bankrupt. It's just one of those things that every time it happens, the company dramatically improves, in my opinion.
Oh, yeah.
There was a time, and I talked about it on the podcast. There was a time this year in May where I made some bad mistakes. Like I made some really dumb strategic mistakes last year, November, which caused a... €500,000, €600,000.
No, it's about the same level mistake. We're talking about the same level mistake.
Yeah. When you see that coming up, how does it feel to you?
You know, this is something that I've been really careful about what I say, the words I say to myself, right? Because both you and I should be proud that we made a fucking decision, right? And we can't always make great ones. There's going to be times where we just really think something's going to be the right way to go. Someone needs to pull a trigger. We pull the trigger and, you know, it wasn't the right call.
Yeah.
Most people don't even get on, I forgot, what's that metaphor? Like get to bat, get the whatever. I don't know.
There's something American.
Sports. Yeah. Okay, fine.
Something about baseball. I don't know.
There's something baseball and American in there. But most people don't even get on stage, let's say.
Yeah.
Right. And so the fact that we're on here and we're riffing live and we have a whole bunch of people that are here to support us and believe in us is big. We're not going to make every decision perfectly, but if we can listen and if we can identify when we haven't made it right quickly, I think that's all we can do. Clearly, we're both here, right? So we've made more good decisions than bad, but there's going to be some bad ones.
Mm.
I've just been really careful about not beating myself up for that. It'll make me not want to be a founder.
Yeah. There must have been some times where you were like, not even just the financial things, but just like, fuck this. Like, you know, I could make more money working at McKinsey or some shit. Like, you know what I mean?
So this might be helpful for people who say that.
Yeah.
When I first started, so again, not knowing that I was starting a company, I was just kind of like freelancing and seeing what happened. I had a job offer for $400,000. And I was like, oh, this is 2009.
Holy fuck.
Yeah, I was like, this is amazing.
That's insane.
Yeah, at that time, I mean, right now, it's like, what, a million, right? Something like, I probably could still do that right now,
that's
right?
Insane.
With
yeah.
what we've built and what I've done, I probably could convince somebody to pay that kind of money now. But what struck me, my brother's awesome at this. He's like a hardcore entrepreneur. And he was like, well, if someone's going to pay you $400,000, they think they're going to make more than $400,000.
Yeah, that's a great way to think of it.
So why don't you think you're going to make more?
Yeah.
Since then, I've never, ever really wanted to do it because I don't want someone else believing in me more than I believe in myself. That's kind of dumb.
That's an interesting one.
That shook me. Not that everyone should be a founder or anything like that, but I just mean like my brother like really helped me see that I just didn't believe in myself. That was like the main problem.
So it's
not sad.
It's not sad. It's very normal. Do you ever feel like as the founder, I mean, this is a common thing when I'm talking to founders, like being the founder is like, you know, you're looking at like people working in companies or your own colleagues and you're like, what would it be like to not have to be the founder? You know, what would it be like to just not have to be the boss and just to let shit happen and just to enjoy it?
I do it all the time. Like, I mean, just even when I see someone working, and it doesn't even need to be in my industry, like when we travel or something, and it's like there's a pilot. And I'm like, ugh, all you do is fly the flight. And you have to fly it well because we're on this plane. But like all day, every day, same thing. And just do it well and get paid. I get jealous of that it's sometimes. Like,
the thing
you don't
is,
have to reinvent everything
it, though.
Today.
You can do it, but they're probably entrepreneurial drive in you prohibits you from doing it. Like you would last 2 weeks, right?
Yeah, I find it very difficult. I mean, I can't even do it for a day.
Yeah.
But I do crave and I'm envious of stability sometimes because we have so much instability.
Yeah.
And we need both in our life. And so sometimes I look at that and I'm like, oh, that sounds so good. Just same thing every day.
Yeah.
No stress. Somebody else is going to make the decision.
Yeah.
You know, that's why I'm doing more of the product-oriented thinking on Insider Insight is that I've met many entrepreneurs who have built that for themselves. They work an hour a week or they have a system that runs and they own the system. Like I invented this idea of conversations instead of interviews. That's my contribution. Now we make it a process. That should scale. I don't need to do the conversations. I don't need to go read the stories. And so I've been thinking of it very differently in this next business around this has nothing to do with Mona, except it's Mona's idea.
Yeah. I think there's a lot of people who get to that point, though. I know a guy, he's after automating his business to like the most ridiculous, like amazing shit I've ever seen. But if you have the personality, which I can see you have, you'll just move on to the next more complicated challenge.
Yes.
You'll keep putting yourself in situations which are really uncomfortable all the time.
Yes, with a break, with a vacation and then a break.
Okay,
No, always. I actually like woke up earlier this week deciding that I might start a school. Like seriously, I'm crazy. And I will continue to keep pushing. And, you know, what I do well is I'm a wrecking ball.
Mm-hmm.
I can see something and just like destroy it and then break it into pieces so that we can rebuild again. I shouldn't do that to the businesses I've already built. And that's what I've learned the hard way is that UX Hires runs really well. You know, Motivate runs really well. Insider Insight's really close. It's still too nascent, but I think by the end of the year, it'll be running really well. And my business partner, Peter, is amazing at running things. Like he's not a wrecking ball.
You brought him in later, right?
I brought him in later. I brought him in about 2 years ago. And oh my goodness, talk about like one of my favorite people on the planet.
Cool.
Just really complimentary and wonderful person. And so I trust him these are my babies.
Yeah.
And I trust him. I trust my nanny. I trust him.
You know? It's the two people you trust. That's great.
Exactly.
That's really amazing. I think we should definitely do another podcast at some point.
Yeah, sure.
By the way, like, I think there's so much I can learn as well. You know, there's a lot of like late teen, early 20s designers listening to this podcast.
Yeah.
A lot of them, even if it is just for, you know, their own career, a lot of them want to start their own businesses. A lot of them
Amazing.
Want to be freelancers. What is like a piece of advice that you could give someone who's, they're at this point where they're feeling the imposter syndrome? Maybe they're thinking, which is like a common thought, like there's too many designers, I'll never be able to stand out. What kind of advice could you give someone like that?
I think all those limiting beliefs are not, no matter what field you go into, whether it's design or being a police person or working in a hotel, like it doesn't matter. There's always going to be reasons why you can't do something.
Yeah.
You know, you need to decide how badly you want it. And so if you want it badly, then my advice would be to amp that up to the highest level that you possibly can. My favorite interviews are like Sean, you know, where they come in and they're like, listen, you know, I will do anything to work here.
Yeah.
Here's my portfolio. What kind of things are you looking for? If I don't have it, can I take 2 days to do it and show you that I'm dedicated, I'm smart, I can figure this out, but I'm really, really committed to working here. Those are the people that work here. I expect that level of interview. The people who come in, like, this is my generic portfolio. And yeah, I mean, I'm interviewing at four places. And
such a shitty thing to say as well. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, we have a staffing arm. Hopefully they can help you find it.
Yeah.
You're not going to work here.
Yeah.
I take it really seriously.
Yeah.
If you want me to pay you literally out of my pocket, you know, like this is like actual my money or your money.
Yeah.
I can either pocket it or I can give it to you. You better earn it. You know, I would strongly suggest to get over those limiting beliefs and then really like come with all the firepower at these interviews. Don't leave until you get the position.
There's like a crazy lack of enthusiasm in a lot of the industry as well.
Yeah, like, they're just like, ugh, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
There's so many designers and my work is really great. It speaks for itself. Like this kind of shit. Like, well, that's not going to work.
Definitely doesn't work when you're interviewing with the founder anyway.
It doesn't work when you're a founder. And also, I mean, I was a young punk too.
Yeah.
It doesn't work when you're a young punk.
Yeah.
Like maybe I could do it. Maybe you could do it now. But you have to earn your way into my portfolio speaks for itself. If you have two projects, it doesn't actually. You know, you need to talk about how you think and how you approach projects and what design means to you and how you feel about following patterns and standards and how you feel about breaking patterns and standards. These kinds of things need to show up in your conversation, in your resume, so that people get excited about working with you. You're selling
yourself.
What
if you have no portfolio though?
Make a portfolio. How hard is that?
Like, what would you put in
things.
It?
I would pick three things. I would design a school. And then put that in there.
Yeah.
I would design a research method.
Okay.
Put that in there. I would design a better hotel room. Put that, like, just take
Make
a
something.
Minute. Yeah. It's, how do you expect someone to take a bet on you if you don't have a portfolio? If you cannot show, here's how I think, here's what I believe, here's my perspective on design. Like, it's so easy to make one. You have 3 weekends.
And you don't mind it not being real work?
Of course not. What I care about is, how did you define the problem?
Yeah.
And then when you define the problem that way, what I'm looking for is like, how big of a leap did you take?
Mm-hmm.
You know, if it's like, oh, and then I moved the button.
Like, and then I put the door over here.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, okay, and there's a place for that. But that's not what we're asked to do. And so our clients would not be able to utilize that skill. There are other places where they need production graphics or they need something along those lines and you can get that role. And that's great. I know many people who have kind of a junior level design role and they are so happy.
A lot of juniors are trying to break out of their junior role though. And they're frustrated.
Actually, I would love to know, what do you think, two reasons, like what do you think they are frustrated by, if you were to guess?
They're frustrated that other people are getting ahead of them. And I guess often they're more angry than actually doing anything to solve it. I feel like a lot of people hurt themselves by being immediately going into a victim state when that happens. And they're like, oh, you know, I've been here for this many years and I'm still a junior and this person, it must be favoritism. It's like, no, you actually don't educate yourself. You don't understand the game.
So the reframe is about design thinking and, you know, nothing about my design thinking is different than anybody else's design thinking. The only difference in reframe is this chapter called excuse personas, where our BS excuse personas start with B or an S and it's exactly what you're saying. There's blamer, which is, you know, it's really the system. It's really someone else.
Yeah.
There's bullied, which is a person who's a victim. It's like, oh, I'm just not smart enough. I didn't go to design school. And
don't have time to read because
I don't have time to read. And like, oh, everyone's so much better than me.
Yeah.
And then there's the fucking brat, which I see a lot in design, which is I should just be promoted.
Oh, this is so fucking prevalent. The problem is that they really don't get anywhere.
No, they're
like, they get a little bit sometimes. They just slowly, iteratively get a little bit more, but nobody wants to promote them.
Because you're a brat.
It's such a good one. I need to read your book.
if you want something, most of the time, if you don't have it, just turn the mirror back to yourself and try to figure out what is it about what I'm doing, saying, feeling that's not in alignment with my goal. Like, that's it. Every time. I mean, look at how much we've achieved. There's millions of dollars that we have closed, right? Why? Because we know we want to do something. And so we just get everything out of the way that prevents us from getting there.
Right.
That's what I want designers to do. That's what I want design researchers to do, is just have your goal. You know, I want to get promoted, let's say, and then figure out what do I need to do to get there?
Yeah. Sometimes it's also just being humble and saying that you're not like the perfect person and you need to figure stuff out. Like, often I think that there's like a lack of being humble. I don't know how to say it.
Like, it's so true.
I know my place. You know, I'm here this week with Jake, who I do the podcast with. I know my place in that like hierarchy, right? I am the young person who knows a lot less than him, right? And even though I'm like really rash and loud and crazy and I can do really good work, at the same time, I still have maximum respect and maximum like,
I think that
humility.
Respect, yeah. Well, it's wonderful. I mean, obviously you're awesome, but the respect and the humility is part of what makes you charming, which is part of what gets people to take interest in you and have your back.
Yeah.
And so getting that promotion, and I've gotten many promotions before I started Motivate, is not about just me. It's about my team wanting to
right.
work for me.
Right. Yes.
It's about my boss feeling like I want to give more responsibility yeah. to her.
Yes.
You know, and so kind of seeing yourself as a collective part of the whole and where you can serve other people. This is back to user-centered design. As I see it, you're not user-centered. You're you-centered, really, if you're trying to get promoted by just stepping on people and talking about yourself all day. Think about, what can I do for my boss? What can I do for this company? What can I do for my colleagues? Where can I add more value?
Yeah.
And then see what happens.
Before we close it off, I just want to tell people something that they should really never do. And I've seen this like multiple times now, not just at my company, but other founders. Employees trying to find out what other people and other companies are getting paid for the same job, or within their company, what people are getting paid.
Yeah.
And not going and saying, hey, I'm more valuable, just going and saying, hey, why is that person getting paid more than me?
Oh, gosh.
I don't know if this has happened to you, but this is something that's like super common right now, is that people almost have this like, they feel like they deserve something, even though they're not doing anything, just because someone else got something. And it's all about someone else. It's all about someone else got something that I didn't get.
It's fascinating.
It's crazy.
One of the most painful moments I had to deal with is, we had this designer and she was really, really talented and wanted substantial more money.
Yeah.
But her skill set wasn't to the place where we could charge for more money.
Yeah.
And so I tried to explain that to her and she would just take it so personally. And I'm like, you need to be here at a director level in order for us to charge that much money and then make money on you. You're actually asking us to pay you more than we charge for your time. And she's like, yes. Like, oh my God.
I will not improve myself. Just yes.
She's like, yes, that's what I'm asking for. I'm sure you can make money on other people.
Yeah.
I'm like, I'm sorry, babe, but my job is to make sure that the company runs smoothly.
Yeah.
You know, and that we all have money and we all have longevity here. What you're asking for is not in alignment with my job. So that's not going to work.
Even if she took a moment to understand that you run the business, and from your perspective, I actually think that she could have turned it around if she had actually played that differently. Same skill set,
yes,
I think she would have been able to turn it around.
How?
Just by understanding you. So you're the gatekeeper in that case, right?
In this case,
if she had put some effort into figuring out ways to make you look good, if I was her, I'd be like, what does Mona want? Fuck, you know what? It would be really cool if Mona somehow got connected with Tim Brown. Let's just say
it's
like
so
Tim
true.
Brown at Ideal.
It's
like,
so true.
Wouldn't that be like fucking cool? I think she would be able to like really do something with the business. And so I'm actually going to put some effort into connecting these two people.
I love that.
See,
you're
absolutely
right.
This is the shit that I do, by the way.
That's
also
right.
being humble.
It's moving up. Like, I get really picky with negotiations because if you're going to be across the table from me, how is that going to work? It's coming over to my side saying, we both want me to make more money. So what do I need to do? I need to get you more money to pay me.
It's so simple.
It's so simple. It's like, come over to my, instead of being head to head with me saying, this is what I want, this is what you want. We're never going to be able to split the difference in the middle.
You're also never going to really give that person, let's say if the company gets sold, right?
Yeah.
You're going to be looking at the people who you really feel like have your back.
Critical.
And you're going to be maybe even like, you know, if AJ and Smart gets sold or whatever, I'm going to be looking and saying, okay, you know, these people, they deserve some sort of a payout for that, right?
Yes.
And it's not going to be the people who are like, hey, listen.
I showed up, I did my job.
I'm here, so I want this. Jesus, it was really
so much more to talk about.
No, but that's really, really cool. Just having like a total, let's say, agency ramble session. I don't know. I think people will enjoy hearing this, but I enjoyed having this conversation.
Yeah, I think it's great for people who want to start their own. part of what we talked about.
Yeah, which is a large part. And they start their own business regardless.
Yes, regardless.
It doesn't have to be an agency. The same good and bad comes up at all times.
So true.
Mona, where can people find you online?
So now I've learned my lesson that there's Instagram. Which I can be on. Jonathan has been really inspiring me to be on more on Instagram. So that should have, if I follow through my promise to him, a lot
you
of information.
You have like 4 weeks before this episode comes out.
Oh,
so
yeah.
You need to get your shit together on
oh
that.
Oh my God,
one.
Still.
You haven't been talking to the camera enough.
I know. I was
at all.
To do that today with
yeah.
you. So Instagram is one. Obviously, motivatedesign.com has all the information.
What's your Instagram for people
Mona
who don't
Mona K. Patel.
K. Patel.
Mona K. Patel.
At Mona K. Patel.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Follow at Mona K. Patel on Instagram. What are you on Twitter?
At Mona Patel.
At Mona Patel on Twitter. And Motivate Design?
Yep.
Just Motivate Design.
Just motivatedesign.com.
Good domain you got there.
Thank you.
Thanks so much, Mona.
Thank
it was a
you.
Pleasure. And I hope you I have you on the show again soon.
Thank you.
Goodbye.
Bye.
All right, everybody. I am back. I hope you liked that episode. Really, really great sitting down with Mona Patel, founder and CEO of Motivate Design and UX Hires and Insider Insight and all of that other stuff. What you should definitely do is follow Mona on Instagram and say hey to her. She is really fucking cool, and I really want her to use Instagram more often. She has started doing some Instagram stories now that I kind of convinced her. So she is Mona K. Patel, all one word. So at Mona K. Patel on Instagram. Definitely go there and give her some love. So I hope you enjoyed that episode. We'll be back next week with myself and Jake chatting and rambling for an hour. I just received the, if you listen to last week's podcast, the one with Scott Belsky, I actually just received his book in the mail, The Messy Middle. This thing is a beast. So if you're wondering what I'm reading at the moment, I'm reading The Messy Middle, but it looks like I've been reading that for about 20 years. Really, really interested in checking that out. You can follow me on Instagram at jicecream. We would love, I would hugely appreciate if you review this episode and if you share it with a friend. It sounds crazy, but if you share this episode or if you share this podcast with people, then more people listen to it. And then we get more excited about doing more episodes. So that's how it all works. Have a good one. Have a lovely week and goodbye.